It's Monday, June 24th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today in The New Yorker, there is an article on Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. It's titled, John Fetterman's War: Is the Pennsylvania Senator Trolling the Left or Offering a Way Forward for Democrats? Those are the two choices. Well, in case you were wondering where Fetterman was on the question of Israel, this is the war in question, by the way. Here he was a couple of weeks ago on Fox. Yes, Fox asked, should Israel go into Rafah?
Well, I follow Israel on that. I mean, they would know the situation more than I do. And I'm always trying to center this to people where it's like Hamas could, well, they started this. They did this kinds of terrible things. And this could end right now if they send all those hostages back home. And they could surrender and all the, you know, but they clearly don't care about all the Palestinian death and chaos and damage. In fact, that's the way they designed that. Israel actually cares about minimizing those civilian deaths, but Hamas sees that as just their own kinds of collateral damage.
There he is, trolling the left, or saying something 100% consistent with the policies of Antony Blinken, Lloyd Austin, Joe Biden. I guess Austin or Blinken would preface it with, well, we've told the Israelis to be cautious. We've expressed our concerns. At this point, they might add something like, we're pleased that their comportment has been restrained thus far. They might not add that, but they do think that. So why is Fetterman trolling the left as opposed to just saying what he believes, has always believed, and is consistent with his beliefs? There's nothing in his record or past pronouncements that would constitute a different stance on Israel. Perhaps it's his hoodies, or dreaded word here, vibes, that convince the left that in Fetterman they'd get a squad-like critic of Israel. But his stances don't really surprise me, or I should say they did, but when I thought about it and looked into it, I said, well, you know, they shouldn't surprise me. The fact that they were surprising was a misreading on my part of what he has always said or stood for. Fetterman is very different from the normal Democratic politician, and it's not that he's more left or more right. It's mostly his shtick. He actually isn't that difference in terms of substance from the modal Democrat in the Senate, however agonized that average Democrat wants to appear over Israel. And I think a lot of them aren't particularly agonized, except in how it might hurt their standing is in the polls. But since only a third of the Senate is up for election, they're not particularly horribly agonized. And Fetterman was never going to play the saying things he doesn't think game. There's another issue in which Fetterman is somewhat impolitic as compared to his other senatorial Democrats. It's his scathing rebuke of Bob Menendez.
I've been calling for that sleazeball has to go.
Not exactly in keeping with the decorum of the caucus, but it is consistent with who he is and who he has always been. Now, is this trolling anyone? Does anyone look at him as an outlier in this case and point a finger or say it's troubling? No. Because when you're in politics, some call it a lack of diplomacy, but when that's your stock in trade, your lack of diplomacy occasionally thrills the listener if they agree with what you're being undiplomatic about. They call it refreshing. They say it's telling it like it is. It's honesty. When your bluntness appalls the listener, they wonder, who is this? How dare he? Is he trolling? I say John Fetterman's not changed that much. We just have in Israel an issue that divides and cleaves the Democratic Party to some extent, while for Fetterman, it's not a very hard call, never has been a hard call, not a call that he needs to talk about in a way that's different from how he talks about most things, which is with bluntness and without varnish or fear. On the show today, should Joe Biden be more like Lincoln? Brad Lincoln, the former first-round pick of the Pittsburgh Pirates with a career record of 9-11? No. Abraham Lincoln, but also no. Not Abraham Lincoln. He shouldn't be like him. I'll explain. But first, climate investor, activist, and former presidential candidate Tom Steyer is out with a new book. It's titled Cheaper, Faster, Better: How We'll Win the Climate War. We discuss why he went all in on climate, electric cars, and how the EV market is going to both boom and vroom. Do they vroom? They sort of vroom. Anyway, Tom Steyer is up next. Tom Steyer is a billionaire investor, an environmentalist. You probably remember him from the 2020 presidential race. And as I found out reading his new book, Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War, without Tom Steyer, we might not have had The Usual Suspects and American Pie. So that will not be the focus of this discussion. Tom, welcome to The Gist.
Mike, thank you for having me.
Did you know, before we get to everything else, did you know what you had in The Usual Suspects?
Absolutely not. Our rule was, this is a financing business. Let's make sure we get the finances right. Our only rules were no softcore porn, no extreme violence, movies that we can be proud of, or at least not ashamed of. And then it turned out that we financed some unbelievably great movies.
Would you say American Pie is just this side of softcore porn?
Yes. And I will say this. I went home and said to my family, this is a movie about four kids trying to lose their virginity in the last month of high school. And everyone in my family goes, haven't they made that movie 100 times before?
Yeah. And it's been successful. In fact, fun fact for you, for many years, Porky's was the most successful movie in the history of Canada. It's a Canadian movie. Okay. If you get nothing else from this interview, you got that. So you have been, an environmentalist can mean many things, but you're very practical. And even if you don't explicitly say this, you obviously view our environmental disaster dilemma through the lens of bets and an analysis that involves risk and trying to allocate resources in the smartest possible way. So my first question is, do you think other environmentalists, people who are aligned with you on the cause, don't have that orientation, and does it hurt the cause in general?
Well, Mike, I want to put myself in perspective and in contrast to many of my extremely close friends who are involved in the same movement, which is I'm a professional investor. I've been a professional investor since I was 22 years old. And that's what I've done as a career. And being an investor means, you use the word bet, but it is really about assessing the future, thinking what's going to happen, what can I do to be part of the good things? What can I do to avoid the bad things? And what can I make the good things better? And so that is a way of thinking about the world and also allocating resources, as you said, that's completely alien to a way of thinking for most human beings. That's just not how they think. And so an awful lot of people come to environmental problems from a scientific standpoint, which is, here's the problem. The point about being an investor is, okay, that's the first point to get to. But the real point is, what are we going to do about it? How do we solve that problem and turn it into an opportunity for us to have a better life?
So where has your orientation led you where others to insights that others might not have?
Well, I think that one of the things about being an investor is you have to be, as you said, completely practical. And if you think about the title of the book, Cheaper, Faster, Better, it's like producing a product that works is not nearly good enough. You know, for a long time, people were pushing for solar power, but it was much more expensive than fossil fuel power. And in this world, no one is going to buy much more expensive commodity energy to try and be nice. And that's exactly what happened. People didn't do it. What happened was the cost curves crossed. You know, if you think about the story that I tell in the book, one of my best friends who is what I would think of as a traditional business Republican who loves cars, who is a car guy, who when I first met him at the age of 18, put me in his car and went up, showed it could go up to 100 miles an hour, had been driving expensive European sports cars and traded in for a Tesla. And I said, Matthew, are you trying to save the world? And he was like, absolutely not. This thing has pickup like you can't believe. It handles really well. And his basic point, my point is cheaper, faster, better. That we're going to win this because people are going to buy things that they want, that serve them, and that we're going to have to come up with an awful lot of innovations. We're going to have to build an awful lot of companies and businesses, because business and profits scale. And that's how you solve a global problem.
So let's take Teslas or EVs. As of 2023, the latest figures I saw said that 0.83% of all registered cars were electric vehicles. So it's great that it's so much more than a few years ago. And if you go to some Nordic countries, that number is touching the double digits. But we're, of course, going to have the internal combustion engine for years and decades. And so then you have a problem. Well, what do we do in terms of extracting the oil to power those cars that we need, or else the economy grinds to a halt? So what do we do? Do we stop production, or do we acknowledge, of course, we have to keep extracting oil, extracting fossil fuels? We know what it does to the environment, but we're committed to it. Otherwise, we'll never even have enough riches to get to the solution.
So let me just disagree politely with your assumptions. Your assumption is that you're using the amount of cars that are existing EVs. Is that in the United States or worldwide?
Yeah, that's U.S.
Right. So let me say the U.S. is not the world, particularly around cars. That in fact, the way that new innovations in general for the last couple hundred years have worked is it follows kind of an S-curve, which is it takes a long time for them to be better than the status quo technology, whether it's whale blubber or kerosene or now oil and gas. But when the cost curves cross and when the new technology is legitimately better, it goes up in an, you know, almost vertically. Mm-hmm. So if you look, for instance, in the largest car market in the world, which by the way is China, 30% of the cars sold last year were EVs. The expectation is 80% of the cars sold in 5 years in China will be EVs. That will be true around the world because they're so much cheaper to buy, so much cheaper to maintain, and so much cheaper to fuel up. So that in fact, we literally cannot afford to do the amount of emissions, pollution associated with fossil fuels for the next 30 years. We literally cannot afford it. And you can see that in terms of not just the climate statistics that no one pays any attention to, but the events coming from the changes in climate that are coming every day, and where there are things happening around the United States that are significant, that are all connected by the fact that the climate is changing, and which are incredibly expensive to human safety, human incomes, and to our future.
So China does have more cars, but it's not tremendously more cars than the United States. They have 320 million cars registered. The United States has 280 million. Of course, China has five times the population, but the United States is much richer. So the United States' lack of pickup compared to China, no pun intended, it shows a lot of things, but it's significant. You're right. I acknowledge the United States is not the world. But when it comes to cars, it's a large part of the world market, as is Europe. And all the projections say that we're going to have cars with internal combustion engines on the road for years and years to come. So the question
is definitely true, Mike.
Okay.
I'm not disagreeing with that. What I'm saying to you is the pace at which it changes follows a very consistent S-curve through technologies for hundreds of years, and this is following it as well.
Right. So my question is, and I read all your stuff about whales and blubber and the great excerpts from 1858 shipping publications that weren't on the right side of history, unless maybe you're a whale. But the question is, this is a hard choice. This is a hard choice thrust upon us. And if we say one day things will get better, and I believe you, I think it's a good story. What will we do in the meantime? We do need to extract a ton of oil, sadly, unfortunately, in the interim, don't we? I don't want to subsidize the oil companies, but what should we do in terms of saying, no, we won't be drilling for oil. We'll just let the Russians and our competitors do that since the world will need oil?
I absolutely agree with the idea that we're not getting off fossil fuels in the short term or the medium term. I understand that. But I also understand that we literally cannot afford not to reduce emissions very substantially between now and 2030 and really get to net zero by 2050. So when we think about what does that mean, well, let's talk, if you're going to talk, what you're really talking about is oil reserves, oil and gas reserves. We literally cannot afford to produce half of the proven oil and gas reserves in the world. right now. If you look at in terms of what it would mean from an emission standpoint to do that, that would be, I think we're going to go with the word disastrous. Mm-hmm. So that, but my, the point of the book I wrote is we need to win in the marketplace. Right now, I would bet you know, there are EVs sold in China for $8,000. Yeah. You know, we're just at the beginning of dropping the cost of electric vehicles. And the reason for that is an electric vehicle is kind of a car surrounding a battery, and that's it. There are many, many fewer. It's really a big battery. And the technology in battery is going through revolutions. We will have two revolutions in batteries this decade. And that's going to bring down the cost and drive up the range of EVs. So that, in fact, this is going to be a superior technology which is going to be shown in terms of cost and performance. And that is what that is the S-curve, is when somebody sits there and goes, it's cheaper, it's faster, it handles better, it's way easier to control. But it has to happen this way, Mike. And that's why the reason that I'm optimistic is I'm looking at these technologies every day as an investor. It's like, wow, they're terrific. People don't realize that the innovations that are coming and that are here are so terrific. I tried to highlight the young people in this book who are leading this revolution, both, you know, especially on a technological basis. And they're coming up with amazing stuff. And that is actually how we're going to win.
Yeah, I'm optimistic too. In fact, I was looking at looking into buying an EV, a Chinese EV sold in Mexico to see if it would be street legal here. They don't allow it. But it is so promising. But my question on this is, you're an advisor to Gavin Newsom. You you have a lot of relations with Gavin Newsom over the years. You were the chief advisor of his task force on the economic recovery. You put sustainability at the forefront of what you were trying to do. You achieved a lot. The Biden administration has choices to make about whether to allow or not allow drilling in the United States. My preference would be for us not having to need it. And I am optimistic, but you know, optimism doesn't get people to work, right? You don't put an 87 hoptane instead of octane level gas in your car. In the interim, is there evidence that were we to ban drilling or stop excavation for oil in the United States, that that would in some way drive down supply of oil? I mean, I've heard theories that if we stop producing the oil, we'll have to get off the oil. But I don't know that beyond that sentence, there is any empirical data showing that that's true.
So let's step back for a second, Mike, and talk about the different forcing functions in how we go forward. And the assumption that you're making is that, which is a commonly made assumption, is that the forcing function is we need to have fuel to drive our economy. And that that is the most important thing. And if we don't have that, you know, it's devastating for us. Let me say, we do have alternatives that are, if they either aren't cheaper, faster, and better now, they definitely will be. And that those are things which are, I can go through each one of the cases for fossil fuels, but the forcing function is really about the very near term. You're talking about a maybe 5-year problem, and you're talking about a maybe 50-year solution.
Okay.
So you're saying in five years, where do you
predict EV take up will be in the United States in 5 years?
I'm predicting EVs will be much cheaper at every level and have higher performance than internal combustion engine cars.
Okay, so something with, like 10,
very
15,
clearly.
10-15% of cars will be EVs in 5 years?
Well, the real question is this. Even if they're 80% of sales, mm-hmm. no one's going to turn in their car. The old internal, when you say 80%, it's like, okay, every year, if that's the way the sales go, how long do people drive their cars? 12 to 15 years? So if you add 15 years to where we are now, is it going to take that long for us to get rid of them? Yes, I totally understand that. But let me make the other point. You are assuming the forcing function is economics. And I'm saying my whole point of my book is to say we have to win economically. Mike is going to claim we have to win economically. Everybody's going to claim we have to win economically. So let's go win goddamn economically.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Check. But let me make the other point. The true forcing function is, Are we, in fact, going to be preserving a world that is inhabitable by human beings safely? That is the, and so when you say the forcing function is the cost of jobs and the availability of energy at a reasonable price, check. Okay, now, along with that, there is the cost of home ownership in Florida and home insurance in Florida. Okay, did you include that in your numbers? Then there is the cost of what's going on right now in Texas, in Houston, Texas, where hundreds of thousands of people have their power knocked out by a storm. And in fact, they're having an absolutely unusual heat wave that is dangerous for human beings to live in. Check. I mean, you look at the costs that are not borne by the fossil fuel industry, caused by the fossil fuel industry. And you say, really, Mike, you're looking at the economics, but are you looking at all the economics, or are you looking at the economics to the fossil fuel industry? Because when you look at the future of the United States, we are confronted with a crisis. We've been confronted with a bunch of crises before, and this country was built to lead the world to solve big problems. That's who we are. That's what we do. That's what we're best at, and that's what we're proud of ourselves for. And here's a big one for us. We can't solve it in the Democratic Party. We have to solve it as Americans. We have to solve it with people who know a lot about energy. So here is a chance for us to do something and win together and recognize each other's strengths and value. People on a winning team love each other. Why don't we go back and win this problem and do what we do best, which is pull together and come up with solutions for the world?
Do you think the climate or environmental movement has been too beset by doomerism?
Definitely. I mean, I think the reason I wrote the book was I felt there were two very common, what I think of as misapprehensions. One is that fossil fuels power this economy and always will, and that just can't be true and isn't true. And the second one is we're in a doom loop of climate disaster and that we can't get out of it, so we should just throw up our hands. This is a big problem, but it's a problem we definitely can solve, that we have to solve, and we definitely will solve it. It's just a question of how fast we decide to do it and how fast we pull together to succeed.
So how do you, and I read your, what you do in the book is lay out a more optimistic case, and you draw on facts, and you talk about all the advances, for instance, in technology. We talked about batteries a second ago. Climate capture is very interesting. There is a slice of the environmental movement that says, you know, when you talk about carbon capture, what you're really doing is playing into the industry's hands and trading on false hope. And what the best thing we could do is just put it off the table, assume it won't happen. And in some cases, there is a lot of rhetoric and thought that it's a grift. You know, you always hear this. How do you think about incorporating the technologies that aren't going to solve the problems on their own, but could become a part of the solutions mix?
They're a critical part of the solution. And it isn't something you can put off, Mike. I mean, to give you some very simple numbers, just to put it in perspective, about a quarter of the solution is going to be what we think of as sequestration, basically sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and sticking it in the ground one way or another. It's a quarter of the solution. We absolutely need it. Three quarters of the solution, that means, has to be reducing how much pollution we emit. But we're definitely going to be emitting pollution, so we need to have a way of basically nullifying that. And that's known as sequestration. And so the idea that we should put it off, to my mind, that's very impractical. That's kind of looking away from a realistic future, that in order for us to succeed and get to, quote, net zero, we have to, you know, figure out ways to reduce the carbon in the atmosphere. And there are a bunch of different ways, and they're all technological, and they're going to take a lot of work and thinking and innovation and company building. And that's exactly what I believe Americans do, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And so to me, you know, why don't we face, to me, the biggest question here is on all sides, let's face the facts. Let's look at the future honestly. Let's be honest with ourselves, and then let's succeed. That's exactly where we are. The data is, we have a problem. So what? We've had a lot of big problems before. That, let's be honest with ourselves. We're not babies. Let's face up to it and solve it. And a definite part of that is sequestration.
The name of Tom Steyer's book is Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War. The thesis is interesting. The little details along it serves as a backdoor biography of Tom Steyer, where you find out his father was a Nuremberg prosecutor. You find out it didn't do so well on the Yale soccer team, and that he did.
Hey, watch it.
And that he did, in fact, fund the Usual Suspects. Tom, it was great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Mike, nice to talk to you, too.
And now the spiel. People love giving candidates advice before a debate. People, American people, also love quoting Abraham Lincoln, citing Abraham Lincoln, looking to Abraham Lincoln for ideas about leadership. A few days ago, an op-ed in the Washington Post written by Francis Barry did just that. Barry wrote a book where he drives around and thinks of Lincoln and therefore gave Joe Biden some of the advice he was thinking of. And his advice was, Joe, you need to think like Lincoln. Barry was specifically citing Lincoln's pivot to the middle, where to reassure nervous slave owners, he endorsed the Fugitive Slave Act, allowing slave masters to reclaim their human chattel. If this was the foot-in-the-door pitch, Joe, hear me out, Slave Act, I would not hear the rest of it out. But Barry does go on. It's a fully commissioned op-ed. And there was a part which got fewer howls from people in the media than endorsing the Fugitive Slave Act, or whatever the 2024 version is. I will read now from Barry's advice. Lincoln separated himself from his party's radical wing, assuring his audience that he was neither an abolitionist nor a believer in black equality, and reaffirming his support for the right of enslavers to reclaim their, quote, fugitives. The Biden campaign should look for opportunities to underscore its separation from the party's far left, especially on issues where Trump is inflaming fear, such as crime, wokeism, and border security. First of all, to compare the current far left to the radical Republicans of Lincoln's time is not a great comparison. Back then, Thaddeus Stevens and Lincoln's first vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, not only were they right on the issues, but they were also politically astute. And they were in a position of, if not total dominance, then strong influence within their party. The current picture is quite different for the current Democratic Party, what you might call its more radical wing. But check out the three areas of moderation that Barry speaks of. Separation from the party's far left, especially on issues where Trump is inflaming fear, such as crime, wokeism, and border security. All right, wokeism, that's all in the eye of the beholder, and it's just not a driver of voter sentiment. Some, including Ron DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy and every talk show host, want you to believe it is, but it's really not. It's not proven to be a big issue. And also there's the question, how can Biden break with wokeism in a debate? What does he do? A land unacknowledgement, listing LGBTQ, but then pointedly saying, and I'm stopping there. Okay, let's get to border security. This is an actual legitimate crisis. I'm going to call it a crisis. It's exacerbated by Trump's forcing the failure of the compromise immigration legislation that James Lankford worked on. But it is a big issue, and it is a big vulnerability. But where should Biden show moderation? He has shown moderation in his proposals. His proposals are thwarted by the legislature and Trump. The third idea is the one I really want to talk about, moderating on issues of crime. Well, like the border crisis, crime is setting records in the United States, but they're the good kind of records. Crime is extremely low currently. The FBI released data for the first quarter of 2024, reporting a massive decline in crime across the board compared to the first quarter of 2023. Jeff Asher, who's been on The Gist, is an excellent analyst of these trends, combed over all the data, and it doesn't account for a quarter of all police departments. And he does say, take it with big grains of salt, the plunge as recorded is overstated, but it's still a plunge. He writes that violent property crime are probably not down 15% nationally, which would be far and away the largest one-year decline ever recorded in both categories, but they are likely down by a healthy amount. Murder is down a ton, probably historically so at this point in the year, but probably not 25% nationally. That's what the FBI data is showing. Okay, but we know there is no good evidence other than this. Crime's down a lot. And during the Trump presidency, crime, specifically murder, increased tremendously. 2020 was the biggest one-year murder spike of all time. To be fair to Trump, as Trump would never be to his opponents, it's not really or wasn't really Trump's fault. There was a pandemic. But what happened during the Biden years, just look at the graphs, look at the charts, look at the stats. Crime was high. It was stubbornly high. It was only going down a little bit. Voters went to the polls in 2022, and they were legitimately worried about crime. And Democratic politicians and Democratic-leaning outlets said, oh, crime's not that bad. But it was bad. It was pretty bad. So maybe credibility was lost. But time moves on. Trends emerge. Patterns need to be taken into account. And now, here in 2024, it is just the fact that crime is not bad. In fact, it is very, very good. The low levels of crime are very good. Crime dropped a lot during the Biden presidency. He doesn't have to tack anywhere. He doesn't have to pivot. He doesn't have to moderate. If I were him, I'd just take credit. Just say the fact. The recommendation of Mr. Barry, for whom it's unclear if he's aware crime is down so much, of using Lincolnian rhetoric is so unhelpful because Lincoln and Biden are in mirror images of each other in terms of the perception to information environments they're operating in. So the American voter in 2024 is overwhelmed by information, desperate to get away from information. Much of the information is of questionable provenance and accuracy because it is so very easy to supply everyone with information they want and don't want. Lincoln operated at a time when the public was desperate for information. The debates that Barry writes of were the Illinois Senate debate of 1858, Lincoln-Douglas debates. Back then, messengers would hustle shorthand transcripts of the three-hour debates to train stations, and then stenographers on the trains would translate these long transcripts, and then they'd get them to the papers in Chicago, and the papers would begin to print, and then telegraphs would carry the accounts throughout the nation. More than 10,000 people showed up in person for most of the debates. A voracious appetite to read and pore over every word. The disagreements were not over facts, but of interpretations and intention. Douglas and Lincoln were offering different visions. They weren't actively lying about each other's position or state of the country. They were critiquing it. Everyone knew there was a problem of slavery. Not everyone. I shouldn't say it that way. Many Americans didn't know there was a problem of slavery. They thought there was a problem of abolition of slavery. But they can agree that was the issue. But with Biden, there is not a problem of crime. There might be the perception of crime. That's a misperception. Every credible news outlet will say it's actually a misperception. The message won't get through. If Joe Biden, not his surrogates, if Joe Biden himself were a forceful communicator on this point, it would open eyes. He would own the issue. It's a good issue for him. We'll see if he's able to do something about it. The border. Now, that's closer to an analogy about the slavery issue in that Biden does not want open borders, although Trump will smear him and say he does. This is kind of like Lincoln's situation. He actually didn't want to end slavery. He wanted to stop its expansion. So yes, perhaps Biden could better explain himself, but he explains himself all the time. The problem is you can't stop the influx of immigrants without the necessary tools, and the tools aren't an executive order. And back to woke again, wake up with woke. It's just not the most salient issue, even if it's annoying to lots of voters, right, center, and even liberal. So it's all a bunch of really bad advice for Biden. It also wasn't the best strategy for Lincoln in the moment. It is true that the clarity of his words, his vigor, his vision won him a national following. That said, Lincoln lost the 1858 election. Also, remember, big difference, people didn't vote for senator then, the state legislatures did. Further, keep in mind that at the 1858 Lincoln-Douglas debate, Lincoln was 49 years old, Douglas 45. They spoke off the cuff for 3 hours. They had no moderator. The shortest exchange during a Lincoln-Douglas debate was a half hour. I would say, unless Biden wears a stovepipe hat or Trump develops sudden onset Marfan syndrome, the 1858 Lincoln-Douglas debate might be the least apt analogy for what we're going to see on Thursday. Oh, there's also very little chance on Thursday anyone's going to endorse fugitive slave capture. And if they do, contrary to Lincoln, it will not be remembered as a brilliant political move. That's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. I don't mention Leo Baum enough. That guy's our intern, but so much more. He has branded pens. Michelle Pesca is chief table officer of Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, jeeperu, do peru. Thanks for listening.